This afternoon with a talk, and that will address the theme of the day, which I think was Nirvana is Now. Is that what we call it? I called it. But actually, this particular reflection, although touching on that, is more focused on the idea of the deathless, the deathless. But before going on to what that might mean and how that might connect with words like nirvana, I think it's worth pointing out that one of the most striking things about the early Buddhist canon, and although this is primarily preserved in, or we know it through its Pali version, there also exists a pretty much parallel equivalent in Chinese, which is translated from Sanskrit, and also there are bits and pieces in most of the other Buddhist languages, Tibetan, Gandhari, Kharosthi, the lesser known ones. But what these texts all share in common is that for the first time in Indian history, we get a glimpse into an unapologetically human world. Prior to the discourses of the Buddha, literature in India tended either to be religious hymns and so on, as in the Vedas, or philosophical reflections, as in the Upanishads, or else kind of quasi-mythical stories, as are reported, say, in the Mahabharata and other great texts of the Indian tradition. But when we enter into the world of the early discourses, we enter into a world that's filled with people like ourselves. It's true, occasionally a god or Mara or some sort of mythic figure will appear, but always in a somewhat marginal and secondary role. The action, as it were, takes place within a recognizably human world, not filled with great heroes and saints and nasty villains, but actually of ordinary conflicted people from all walks of life. They're not all monks, they're not all nuns. A lot of them are involved in ruling different parts of this world. Some of them are merchants, bankers. Others are doctors, farmers, people from all walks of life. And suddenly we're in this world of this very rich, varied human world. Unidealized, unromanticized, and neither is it demonized. It's simply the setting, the location in which these discourses are given. And I think in order to recover what is distinctive about the Buddha's teaching, it's not just to analyze, you know, what he said on specific occasions, but also to be that much more aware of the people to whom he said these things, the situations or the contexts within which these talks were given. We sometimes have the idea that the Buddha became enlightened and then he just opened his mouth and Dharma came out and it was, you know, memorized and transcribed and bingo, there's Buddhism. But that's a very I think simplistic way of thinking about it. The Buddha was a man of his time and his place, and his teaching was addressed to other men and women of his time and his place. And although when the canon came to be organized, pretty much all sense of chronology was lost, because the texts were organized according to their length. In middle-length discourses, long discourses, discourses that are linked because they deal with numerical lists, discourses linked by theme, connected by theme, as we saw this morning. And in breaking up the body of materials in this way, we completely lose touch with any kind of chronological development. The characters, the people are scattered all over the place. And it's quite a lot of work to try to restore some sense of history or chronology as to when the Buddha gave these talks, in which environments. We have to educate ourselves to know where Kosala was, where Magadha was, where Vajji was, where Mala was, where Sakya was. Otherwise, we read these texts, we hear these place names, we read about these individuals, and we kind of put that to one side and try to find the Dharma, the teachings, which is, of course, you know, that was what these canons were set up to deliver, and they do so, I think, quite well. But the problem is, we tend, therefore, to rather marginalize or forget the context within which these teachings were given. And that, I think, is a serious loss, because it means that very easily the Dharma, the doctrines, become developed somehow in a vacuum. They're just ideas, they're theories, they're metaphysical views, they're instructions in meditation, all of which can be very helpful, but they're often stripped out of context. So like the passage I looked at this morning was again very much located in context. People were wondering what the Buddha did when he meditated. So they ask some of the monks, and the monks go and find out. And there's then a response to a concern that actual human beings had around this particular question. And I find myself that that somehow embodies and embeds the teaching in a world that is recognizably like our own world. It somehow brings everything quite literally down to earth. And the passage I'm going to look at this afternoon, well, the main passage I'll look at, is a very curious text. It only occurs once in the whole canon. It's from the Anguttara Nikaya, the connected discourses, and it's in the sixes, the chapter of sixes, and it's suttas number 119 to 139. 21 discourses. But they're exactly the same with one difference. In each discourse, a different person is named. Otherwise, the text is identical. Now, what the text says is that it declares that there is this householder or this adherent. Adherent is how I translate upasika, usually translated as layman or laywoman. But I feel that actually, talking in terms of monks and nuns on the one hand, laymen and laywomen on the other, we actually are introducing a distinction that very probably didn't exist at the Buddha's time. We're borrowing a language from Christian monasticism, monks and nuns and so on, which is not entirely inaccurate, but I feel somehow it doesn't quite... It suggests something that probably wasn't the case at the Buddha's time. There were no organized monastic centers at that time. The Buddha was not keen on establishing cenobitic monastic communities. As we saw this morning, the monks and the nuns, the bhikkhus, the bhikkhunis, would gather in parks in the rainy season, and then the rest of the time they're basically wandering around on the road, going from place to place. Whether that's an accurate description of a monk or a nun, I'm not so sure. It could be. But I prefer to simply translate the word bhikkhu and bhikkhuni literally as mendicants. These were people who lived from alms that they begged. The word is beggar, but mendicant, I think, works better. And the lay people, so-called, are called upasaka, and upasati, I think, is the verb, means to sit close by. And in other words, these were men and women who adhered to the teachings of the Buddha and his leading disciples. But whether they should be characterized as lay people, which has a certain pejorative sense in the West, I'm not so sure. So I call them adherents. Now, we find in these 21 texts basically a list of 21 householders, in other words, it's used gahapati, and adherents. And this is how they're described. They're described as people who have attained fulfillment in the Tathagata. We looked at that this morning. They have become seers of the deathless, and they go through life beholding the deathless. That's the phrase. These are 21 men who are not mendicants, they're adherents of the Dharma living in the world, who have attained fulfillment in the Tathagata, become seers of the deathless, and go through life having beheld the deathless. And in addition to this, they are said to have attained lucid confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, in other words, the quality of awakening in the practice of the Dharma, the path, and in the community, the Sangha, that supports that. Again, community, Sangha, doesn't mean just the mendicants. It refers to all members of the Buddha's Parisa, assembly, which includes men, women, mendicants, adherents, who have entered the stream of the Eightfold Path. So these 21 householders and adherents are part of the Sangha. They have entered the Eightfold Path, and they go through life having beheld the deathless. So it's a picture, therefore, of people who have arrived at a certain perspective on life that informs their everyday activities. They have a core commitment to being awake, to consciously practicing a way of life that is conducive to being more awake, and they are embedded in a community of friendships that support that process called the Sangha. And as a result of this, they are said to have achieved noble virtue, noble understanding, and noble liberation. Again, the same word noble as we saw this morning. But noble virtue, understanding, and liberation. So these are liberated, free people who have a certain understanding of what they're doing and are grounded in an ethical orientation. Now, this text has actually caused Orthodox Theravadins a certain degree of difficulty because it presents these gahapati, these householders and adherents, as having qualities which are often considered to be the qualities of the arahants, of the more advanced practitioners who are renunciants. Especially this idea that they've achieved noble liberation. That's usually a phrase reserved for the celibate arahant or advanced practitioner within the renunciant community. Now, who were these people? Well, there's 21 names given. It's unlikely that most of us have heard of any of them. The best well-known one is called Anathapindika. He was the banker who financed the Jetta Grove, which was the Buddha's main kind of teaching center. You may have heard of a man called Citta. He was, again, an adherent, but there are a number of suttas where you find him actually teaching the mendicants, or the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis. Mahanama, who was the Buddha's cousin, who took on the job of running Sakya after the Buddha left home. And perhaps you've heard of Jivaka, who was the Buddha's doctor. But the other 17 are obscure. I looked them all up. Some of them we have no information at all, they only appear in this passage. But others, we find that eight of them were merchants, businessmen, financiers. Four of them were either government officials or had a role in leading or governing a community of some kind. And one of them, as I've mentioned, was a doctor. So what we have here is a kind of a snapshot of a group of the Buddha's principal adherents, householders, who were his followers. And we can infer that they were part of the urban, mercantile and ruling class of the Buddha's time. And they were actively involved in establishing the kind of new societies that were emerging on the Gangetic Plain. Because of the institution of monarchy on the one hand and on the emergence of the first cities on the other. The Buddha was born at this very turbulent but changing time in Indian history where the society was moving from a primarily agrarian or agricultural lifestyle into an urban lifestyle. And that again is, I think, significant because the Buddha's teaching, particularly to people like these, was basically addressing the concerns of the needs of people living in quite pressured, leading quite pressured lives with lots of responsibility and duty and risk involved in their work. And we pick this up again and again once we start paying attention to the world, the specifics of the Buddha's world. So for these men, the Dharma was basically a practical way of life that sustained the work they were engaged in the world. So let's try to unpack how, in fact, they are described. The word that appears twice in the text is the word deathless. Now, as I mentioned last night, this is often a word that is automatically capitalized in English, the deathless with a capital D, and again, a definite article, the. We just need to be aware that there is no capital letters in Pali or Sanskrit, Tibetan or Chinese, and there are no definite articles. There's no the or a that we use. So the deathless with a capital D has ratcheted up this idea to a rather privileged position. And it's come to assume this idea of the deathless, sometimes the unconditioned, is some sort of ultimate reality, so the true way things really are, some sort of transcendent, godlike reality almost. Now, what's curious again in translation is that when the word deathless, or the Sanskrit word is amrita, in Pali it's amata. When the word appears in the Upanishads, which it occurs a lot, it's not translated as the deathless in English. It's translated as immortality. And that again, I think, is curious. According to the Hindu philosophy, the Upanishadic philosophy, the aim of the path is to achieve union with God in order that you achieve eternal life. You will never die again. You've become immortal. You've become subsumed into the mind or the being of Brahman, of God. But since the Buddhists don't believe in immortal souls, they can't really translate it as immortality. So we come up with the deathless. That's just a curious footnote, really. But again, I think it suggests how we are struggling to find an idiom. And in doing so, we're juggling words that we're familiar with as having one meaning in some forms of Indian text and a totally other meaning in Buddhism. So if the Buddha did not mean immortality by the word deathless, what did he mean? It's another example of his taking a word that was very common in the India of his time and giving it another meaning. the way he defines deathless is the ending of greed, the ending of hatred, the ending of confusion. Now, in what sense is that deathless? How does that make sense? The ending of greed, the ending of hatred, the ending of confusion. That's the deathless. Now, frankly, that doesn't make a lot of sense, at least at first sight. And I think to understand it, we have to reflect on how he's using and understanding the word death. He's not using the word death here as physical death, because clearly you might be without greed, without hatred, but you're still very much alive. Death here is being, I think, used metaphorically. Greed and hatred, let's say, are basically forms of inner death. In other words, once one is under the grip or the hold of an attachment or a fear or a hatred or, let's say, arrogance or pride, when you get locked into that emotive space, you basically are no longer really alive. You've become identified with a particular emotional reaction that you identify with, and that is a kind of death. Now, there's another term you find in the early canon, again, not very often, it occurs a handful of times, and that is the word kila, K-H-I-L-A, kila in Pali. And kila means something like aridity or barrenness. Aridity or barrenness. And the Buddha understands that the sage, the wise person, is not arid, that such a person is no longer leading a barren life. And when he describes barrenness or aridity, again, it's greed and hatred and confusion. These are emotive reactive states that are somehow barren. They don't bear fruit. Nothing really grows under those conditions. And the other way he describes aridity or barrenness is when you have no confidence in awakening in the Dharma and in the Sangha. In other words, if we put that into more secular language, when your life is not focused on the realization of core values, when your life is somehow devoid of any overriding or governing purpose or goal. And in Buddhism we phrase that in terms of aspiring to be awake, practicing the way of life that leads to that, and sustaining and nurturing relationships that support it. In other words, your life is now focused on certain transcendent goals. Transcendent in the sense that they go beyond your mere self-interest. Another way that the Buddha describes reactivity of this nature is as Mara. Mara is the Buddhist equivalent of Satan, the devil, the demonic. And Mara is depicted in a mythological aspect. Mara is a sort of a demon figure who periodically pops down to earth and has these dialogues with the Buddha. But when the Buddha tries to explain what Mara means, it comes back to the same thing. It comes back to greed, hatred, egoism, and so on. These are forms of Mara. And the word Mara, sorry, let's wait for Dr. Mara. Thank you. Okay, so Mara, the word, is rooted in the root murtyr, which means death. Mara means the killer, the one who brings death. So here we have a quite explicit recognition that greed and hatred and delusion are not just arid and barren, but they're also a kind of inner death. Now, all of this points very strongly, I think, to the fact that a life that is led unconditioned by greed and hatred and so on is a life in which you are no longer caught in the imperatives of death. Again, Christianity has very similar metaphors. Christ overcomes death, as it were, and the Buddha overcomes Mara. And that, if we translate it into more pragmatic language, has to do with living on this earth in a way that's not determined by your greed and your hatred and your egoism, but one that arises out of a life in which you are no longer caught or trapped in those emotive, reactive patterns. And this, I think, is what is meant when we see in this text that such people, these 21 people, have become seers of the deathless. Again, it's seeing, not knowing. So in other words, the deathless, this absence of the power of greed and hatred, is something that you come to see. Not necessarily to know conceptually, but somehow to actually see with your own eyes, as it were. And the same idea is repeated a few words later, where it says that they have become seers of the deathless, and they go through life having beheld the deathless. Beheld or behold is a translation of a word, sachi karoti. Sachi is an old Pali word for the eyes, and karoti is connected to the verb to do. So it's basically, again, to see, to do with your eyes, to eye someone up, we used to say when we were teenagers. In other words, it's an ocular activity. You look carefully at something. Now, I find this interesting. I find the use of these words, I don't think, is just arbitrary or accidental. The word sati karoti appears not very often in the Pali canon, but when it does occur, it always has this same kind of meaning. Sati karoti, this beholding, has to do with the beholding of nirvana, the deathless, the unconditioned. These are the things that are said to be beheld. Now, what does that mean? It's not obvious at all what that means. I think to put it into context, we need to take a couple of steps back. And the background to this move that I'm making is in recognition that the word sati karoti is used in the Buddha's first sermon to describe the experience of nirvana, or the third noble truth, so-called. I'm not going to get into all of the four noble truths and so on, but if we put aside the idea of there being truths that need to be known, and we look at the four that became the four noble truths, and we think of them as four tasks to be performed, which is how the sutta concludes, then the third of the four tasks is to behold sati karoti nirodha, the stopping of greed and hatred and delusion. The second task is to let go of reactivity, greed, hatred, delusion. I'm just going to use the word reactivity for convenience instead of greed, hatred, delusion. I'm also translating the word tanha, usually rendered as craving, I think it's more useful in some ways to think of this as reactivity. It's what rises up, samudaya, when we encounter the world. We react. So the second of the tasks that the Buddha encourages his followers to perform is let go of reactivity. And when you've let go of reactivity, when the reactivity has come to a stop, even momentarily, you then turn your attention to behold the stopping. That's very literally what it says. Nirodham Satchikaroti. Behold the stopping. The stopping of reactivity. But there's another step prior to that. And that is the step which is, in Pali, it's dukkha or dukkham parinyeya. Embrace suffering. So rather than the first noble truth that life is suffering, the second noble truth that craving gives rise to suffering, the third noble truth, etc., we can look at these in terms of the actions that the Buddha associates with each one. Dukkha is to be fully known, literally, parinya, parinyeya. Now what does that mean? In a way, the whole of the path begins with our ability to fully know dukkha. Dukkha means birth, sickness, aging, death. It means the five khanda or aggregates that are basically a description of the phenomenal world that we're in. Our bodies, our minds, our perceptions, our feelings, our consciousness. And the Buddha is saying, with regard to all of that, parinyeya, know it fully. What does that mean? The word pari literally means around. So it's to know things from all angles, to embrace life from as many different perspectives as you can muster. The perspective that's encouraged in Buddhist meditation is be mindful. Or another term that's used is pay visceral attention. Visceral attention. This is usually mistranslated as wise attention. But the word yoniso, which is translated as wise, literally means from the womb. It's attention that comes from the womb. It's a visceral attention. It's a bodily attention. An attention that is not conceptual or theoretical, but is concerned with somehow a kind of almost bodily knowing, a bodily awareness. And this mindful attention, again, is not just stepping back and sort of eyeballing things a bit more intensely, but as we saw this morning, it's comparable to the way that an artisan works the material of his or her trade. It's an engagement, it's an involvement with experience. And last night, for those of you at the talk, I suggested that this kind of knowing is closer to the knowing we find in the word connaître in French, or kennen in German, which is the way we know another person, as opposed to the way we know a thing or a fact. We can't do this in English. We know the difference. It's different to know John than it is to know that 2 and 2 equals 4. But what's being implied, I think, in this parinya, this full knowing, is a kind of embrace in which we engage with the world in a much more intimate way. We encounter a world and we open our arms and our hearts to that world. And so when we do meditation, when we do mindfulness, when we do awareness practices of any kind, we're basically training that capacity to know the world in a more intimate way. When I was at school, we were told that connaître in French means to know another person. But actually, it's more complicated than that. Living in France and using these words all the time, connaître is also what we would say with regard to knowing a piece of music. It's the same, if you know a place, a town, do you know Cambridge? Connaître. Do you know the way to London? Connaître. Do you know that song? Connaître. So connaître, or kennen, is more than just knowing other persons, it's also knowing environments, landscapes, communities, art, music, all of this is known in this rather more non-conceptual, more intuitive way. And curiously, in one passage in the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha defines what he means by parinyeya, embracing, fully knowing. And he says it is the absence of greed, the absence of hatred, the absence of confusion. Exactly the same definition as he gives for deathless, unconditioned, and nirvana. And that's very odd, I find, at least at first sight. But what I think it suggests is that this kind of knowing is a knowing that is not driven or determined by what I want, what I don't like, and what's in it for me. In other words, this absence or this letting go of these instinctive, reactive ways of relating to the world. So this parinyeya, this embracing, is a kind of, we might call it more loosely, a sort of open-hearted equanimity. In other words, it's a quality of knowing in which self-interest has fallen away and which is not determined by what we want or don't want. It's an open-hearted embrace. It has a quality of equanimity and balance within it. And again, that's another overarching metaphor for what we call meditation, I feel. But that's the frame within which mindfulness, for example, operates, or from which this visceral attention operates. So once we start unpacking all of this, and we started here just by taking the word satchiko, beholding the deathless. Beholding the deathless is made possible by letting go of reactivity. And that is made possible by embracing the world without greed or hatred or confusion. And these are the first three of the four so-called noble truths. To embrace the condition we're in, to let go of the reactivity that arises, and to then behold the stopping of that reactivity, even if it's only for a few moments. And the beholding of the stopping of reactivity is exactly the same as beholding the deathless. The deathless, therefore, is a kind of code in the classical language of Indian religion for a free and unobstructed space within us. A space that's no longer clouded or inflected by greed and hatred, self-interest, egoism, etc. And the important point is that this beholding of nirvana, beholding of the deathless, is not the goal of the path. It's actually where the path begins. And this is made very clear in this passage. These people have become seers of the deathless, is what the text says, and they go through life having beheld the deathless. In other words, the beholding of the deathless is the ground that enables you to live your life from another perspective altogether, a perspective that's not determined by reactivity or impulsivity or craving or greed, hatred, delusion, whatever you call it. Now the word again, the phrase again, and if we pick apart the language, what I've translated as go through life is very approximate. The word in Pali is iriyati. And iriya is the word that's used for one's physical posture. Usually there are four iriya: standing, sitting, lying down, walking. That's what we do in the meditation. We sit, we lie down, we stand, we walk. These are the postures. It's a physical term. So in other words, these men are described as people who, having beheld, which is a past participle, the deathless, in other words, having become intimate with that uninflected space of possibility within their own being, they then bodily go about in the world doing their business. And that is the practice of the path itself, the cultivation of the way of life, of the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path, in other words, going about your business in the world to a large degree, is something that has its origins within seeing for yourself, with your own eyes, the possibility that you can live in this world in a totally different way. Now, again, another passage that I've come across fairly recently, actually. It's in the, again, in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses. And these are the last discourse, or they're actually just verses. Each one is called a sutta, but they're actually just verses that constitute the chapter of the ones. The numerical discourses, you have got the ones, the twos, the threes, the fours, the five, the sixes, the ones we've looked at twice today. But the ones, there are actually 627 short sutta discourses in the chapter of the ones. And the last 15 or so concern the deathless. And I'll just read you a few. They're very repetitive, as usual. But these, I'm going to read about five of them. Those who enjoy the deathless, the text says, enjoy being mindful of the body. Those who care for the deathless care about being mindful of the body. Those who cultivate the deathless cultivate being mindful of the body. Those who understand, the word is parinyaya, those who embrace the deathless embrace being mindful of the body. Those who behold, same word, satchikaroti, those who behold the deathless behold being mindful of the body. Now, all of the 15 or so verses operate on exactly the same principle. It has to do with the deathless and the body. The deathless and the body. The deathless and the body. Now, this is very counterintuitive, because in Indian tradition, the one thing that is definitely subject to death is the body. That is the prime place of death. The body dies. And yet here you have the Buddha almost completely subverting that assumption. That if you really want to enjoy, care for, cultivate, embrace, behold the deathless, what do? You pay attention to the body. You enjoy being mindful of, care about, cultivate mindfulness of, embrace being mindful of, behold being mindful of. Now clearly here, deathless is not referring to something that's not literally not dying. On the contrary, the body's dying all the time. It's breaking apart, breaking down, getting older, as we know only too well. So in what sense, therefore, does a heightened awareness of this very death-prone physical body, how is that associated with knowing what is not deathless? Sorry, what is not death? And I think the only way we can really understand this is by understanding death to be reactivity, attachment, fear, grief, all these things. That's the state of being dead. If you want to wake up to your life, pay attention to your body. Start paying attention to your breath. Start paying attention to the sensations that run throughout the body. Start paying attention to what you touch, what you see, what you hear, what you smell, what you taste, what you touch. Paradoxically, for the Buddha, paying attention to what is most ephemeral and impermanent and transitory is what allows you to free yourself from trying to hold on to these things as though they were permanent, trying to fix your body as something that's not going to die, have a sort of conceit in your own immortality, or try to arrange your life by accumulating and controlling as much of the phenomenal world as you can, either in the form of money or buildings or cash or relationships or whatever it might be. That's death. The deathless is when you let go of that kind of habit to try to control and preserve what is by its very nature going to slip out of your control at death. So there's a lot of paradox here. And I don't think we can really appreciate that paradox unless we see the Buddha as somehow operating within a philosophical and a religious context, which he's basically undermining. He's changing the rules of the game. And he's shifting from a sort of metaphysic, truth-based understanding of reality, as it were, and embarking on a practice and a teaching that is primarily about ethics. It's primarily about what you do, not what you believe. It has to do with performing certain tasks rather than gaining knowledge about certain truths. So although Buddhism evolved into a kind of metaphysics in its own right, and the deathless and the unconditioned with their capital D's and capital U's became ciphers of some ultimate reality that the liberated person understood and knew and was thereby freed from delusion, that's a way of thinking that's quite foreign to these earliest texts, where you just don't get that perspective at all. Instead, you have these bankers, merchants, doctors, government officials, and so forth and so on, who have seen the deathless. In other words, they've experienced for themselves that reactivity, when left alone, will come to a stop. In other words, the concluding phrase of the Buddha's supposed first discourse, the turning of the wheel of Dhamma, is whatever is an arising phenomenon, that is a ceasing phenomenon. Whatever arises, ceases. That was how Kondanya, the elder of the five ascetics to whom this discourse was taught, articulated his understanding of what the Buddha had said. Whatever arises is something that ceases. And the words he uses are samudaya, what arises, and what arises is reactivity and craving and greed, hatred, delusion, and what ceases, therefore, is also reactivity, craving, greed, hatred, delusion. If you leave these emotive reactions alone, if you don't identify with them, they're just revealed to be the play of conditions, the play of the mind. They'll arise, that's entirely natural, but then if you leave them alone, they will cease. And that ceasing, that stopping, is nirvana. And that's what I mean by the title of the day, Nirvana is Now. each time that one of these reactions has risen up and stopped, it's the stopping that you then pay attention to. And you learn to somehow refine your appreciation of what it, of the very sort of fabric of that absence, of that stopping. The Buddha also calls this dwelling in emptiness. Dwelling in emptiness also is emptiness of greed, emptiness of hatred, etc. But the point is to learn how to dwell, abide, live in that space, to see and behold that opening of possibility, in order that you can then lead a life in which you respond to the world rather than react to it. And that's the freedom, I believe, that these people are said to have achieved, this Arya Vimutti, this noble freedom. It's nothing particularly exotic or mystical. It's the freedom that we realize is possible when we behold the stopping of reactivity. And that is literally to behold it in your own meditation, your own moment-to-moment experience of life. And the task involved is learning somehow to become more attuned to those moments in your life when you're not being driven by habitual impulse. And that's, I think, quite a lot of the time, in fact. Buddhism, like many religions, likes to make out that human beings are terribly inveterate sinners and awful people driven by greed and hatred the whole time. But that's not really true. Yeah, it's certainly these are great forces and powers in our lives, but they come and they go. And we can know for ourselves when they're there and when they're not there. Last night I gave an example from another sutta where the Buddha asks this man, Sivaka, when there is greed within you, do you know that? Yes, of course I do. When there is no greed within you, do you know that? Yes, of course I do. Ah, then you've understood the Dharma. That's what he says. And the same sort of vision, I think, is to be found in this passage here. These people live their lives, they go about in the world from the perspective of the deathless, of this freedom from that inner death. So what's being articulated is a vision of how we might live more fully. And the Buddha's analysis of the human condition is that we lead very stunted and limited lives because we're so much caught up in our instinctual reactivity. And if we could learn to free ourselves from those forces of death, that would open the possibility to what in Christianity would be called an abundant life. And that, I think, is what the Dharma is about. It's about learning to live more abundantly and more fully, more imaginatively, more creatively, more responsively, more empathetically. And all of that, I think, is, if not utterly explicit, at least deeply implied by texts such as these ones that I'm singling out from within the canon. So I'm going to stop there. And we'll now have a period of sitting, if that's okay, or we could go walking too.